Hey there, it's Mike Tramp, and you're listening to White Line Fever, where rock and roll is still alive like it always has been and it always will be.
Welcome to the show for people listening. It's the first interview of this week's show, but it's the third part of our interview with Pete Jupp from FM. Pete, thanks for joining us the last couple of episodes.
Absolute pleasure.
Just watching some of the clips and some of the interviews before I chatted to you, it occurred to me that in rock bands, the drummer and the singer seem to be the ones who are most at risk of the years catching up with them, because it's a physical endeavor. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And you guys seem to be, it doesn't seem to be an issue. You know what I mean? Like, your singer's still hitting incredible high notes, even though he had a heckler on the album who said average, shouted out average and distracted him. But tell us about that. Is there a fear of, you know, what's it like? What's the physical toll of drumming, you know?
The hardest part for me is actually climbing up onto the drum riser and actually getting back off the drum riser. I've got, my knees are a bit shot and it's actually quite painful. Like, I can't jump off of, you know, I can't jump around like I used to, kind of thing. But, you know, my dodgy knees, they don't affect my playing. Well, maybe some people say they do, but they don't hurt when I'm playing. It's just climbing up on the drum riser. Yeah. So I need a stair lift, I think, you know, take me up there.
Yeah, you're not Lars Ulrich. You don't have a couple of helpers to put you up there.
Right. Well, I would, if I had the money, I would, you know.
Now, I haven't dwelled on the old days a lot. I know you probably do some interviews where people just want to talk about 1986 or something like that. But if you allow me to ask a couple of questions, because you did some amazing supports, didn't you? You know, Bon Jovi, you've already mentioned Meatloaf in the previous program for the people listening. I mean, when you look at, firstly, do you have a lot of sort of souvenirs? Do you have the tour book and the, you know, little souvenirs and the passes from the Bon Jovi tour? And how do you rationalize that now? You look back on it and, you know, it was a part of a narrative in your mind, you know, of your career, and how do you view that period, you know?
It was great. It was great fun, but I actually haven't got any memorabilia at all. I've given it away. I haven't got all the FM albums the collection. No, honestly, you just sort of give them away to people and never replace them. You know, I've probably got a couple of hoodies, which I sometimes wear with FM on. I haven't got any, you know, no, nothing. I remember giving my Slippery When Wet pass to my mate's girlfriend because she was a mad Bon Jovi fan, sort of thing, you know. But now I've got nothing at all, you know, just give things away.
And for maybe we've got a few viewers and listeners who are younger than us, and they probably, they might look at Bon Jovi the way we would look at Fats Domino or Buddy Holly.
Right, you know, yeah.
So how would you describe to them what it was like then and what it meant, and what was it like being on tour with Bon Jovi, and what was the hysteria? That's putting a word in your mouth, I guess. But what was it like during the day and after the show, and why were we into this music so much back then, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we were lucky because on the Slippery and Wet tour in the UK, I think it was Newcastle we were playing. And it's when they first found out that Slippery When Wet had gone number one in the UK and America. And it's just lovely being around them. You know, they were so excited, you know, and psyched about it, kind of thing. They're a lovely bunch of guys. Couldn't have done anything more for us. I remember there was one sound check we turned up at or something, and they were all hungover. They'd been to a casino the night before. And they'd taken a bit longer than they should have done, probably sound checking. And I remember the bass player was holding the doors for us. He said, "Look, this is us. We messed up. We'll hold the doors for you." You know. So no, it was great times, and it was the first time, I think the first gig we did on the tour was Bradford St George's Hall.
Wow!
And it was the first time we'd ever been screamed at. there were girls screaming at us, and it's like, well, this is weird. Kind of nice though, you know. Yeah, no, that tour probably did us more good than any other tour we've ever done. It took us up a level overnight, kind of thing.
Yep. And now they're still screaming. They're still screaming. All
yeah, exactly. Time. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
One more question for the hardcore fans. Maybe there's one or two of them watching as well.
Hopefully.
The next, what's the next move? Obviously, a live album, second live album for Frontiers. Are you?
Yeah.
You've had plenty of time, I guess, to work on studio stuff. What's the story?
Well, we've had plenty of time, but we haven't been able to get together. Mm. So we've been just writing from home. That is one of the great things about computers. You know, we can all do stuff at home now. Well, Steve can't because he can't even work a microwave, you know. But, we've got lots of ideas. Really what we want to do, we want to get out playing live. That's what we want to do because we didn't have a chance to promote or play live any songs from Synchronized.
Right.
So that's what we want to do next. But, of course, that's in the lap of the COVID, you know, sort of thing. But hopefully. Hopefully at the end of the year, things might start returning to normal. But, you know, I just don't know, to be honest.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for my text if anyone from the NHS is watching. Thanks very much, Peter. Really appreciate it. It's been really fun talking to you. For the people listening, what song can we finish with?
Oh, another one. Oh, let's go with the slowy, smoochy one, end of the night kind of thing. Every time I think of you. Hi, this is Pete Jupp from FM, and you are listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back, and our next guest, very special guest from Hookers and Blow. It's Alex Grossi. Alex, coming to us from Las Vegas. How are you, mate?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me.
No worries, mate. I'm doing a bit of research right before this. I know I give the job a bad name by doing any research, but you're actually 6 years younger than me, right? I'm like, it's unbelievable. You must have been the youngest person in every single band you've ever been in.
I always have been, yeah. Actually, no. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. I think 95% of the bands I've been in, I've been the youngest dude, yeah.
And is it like, do people kind of assume that you've been around longer than you have? Do you find people come up to you and think you're older than you are?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's all the time because, you know, the people you're around, you know, they assume, you know, like I've had people come to me and go, dude, I saw you guys in 83. I'm like, cool, I was six. Awesome. But, you know, like I must, yeah, okay. Either I look really bad or you're just, you know, but no, it's by proxy, you know, it's just part of the deal. But yeah, I mean, even when I was a kid, like when I was 15, I was playing in a bar band with 30-year-olds.
Yeah.
You know, it's always kind of been that way. Cause I'm into like old school rock and, you know, growing up in the 90s, everything changed from, you know, over when Nirvana came out. I was still into the 80s and 80s hard rock and everything. So I just, you know, I had no interest in playing Smells Like Teen Spirit at the high school talent show. I aimed a little bit higher.
Now, we're here to talk about the Hookers and Blow album. And the band Hookers and Blow is almost 20 years old now. And it was...
It is. Yeah, we're coming up on our 18th anniversary, yes.
Yeah, and you own the name yourself and Dizzy Reed. So if anyone
we actually got a trademark in 2008. Yeah.
So if anyone wants to, indulge in Hookers and Blow, they need to ring you first, basically.
No, just if they want to have a band or put out a record or sell merch.
All right, okay.
We didn't trademark prostitution and cocaine. No.
All right, okay.
It'd be a little harder.
and I mean, it was a fun cover band, and obviously still is. But now you've put out a record. I mean, how does it kind of happen? I know Golden Robot are involved and, you know, that they kind of maybe nudged you along, but I mean, to put out a record and the stuff in this, it was recorded over quite a long period, wasn't it?
It took about 3 years to get the whole thing done, you know, mainly because, well, we ended up, you know, spending a lot more money than we thought. And this is because Dizzy and I wanted to make something really good. It wasn't a quick little cash grab like a lot of guys do with their little all-star projects. Mm-hmm. We wanted to put something out that we're going to be proud of forever. Like you might have seen us live and it wasn't that good. We had an off night. We had a lot of different versions of this band, but you know, after touring incessantly for like two or three years, you know, we did the tour with the Dead Daisies. Mm-hmm. We did another headliner tour right before that in our own bus, and we kind of got really tight as the unit with Johnny Kelly on drums and Mike Duda on bass. So we, you know, decided it was time to, you know, take this lineup into the studio and do it right.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Golden Robot kind of, when they offered us a deal, I said, I guess, yeah, okay. And they gave us complete control. They didn't stand over our shoulders. They didn't want to approve the mixes. They just said, go do your thing. And that's the best thing about, you know, with Hookers and Blow, because you can't tell us what to do. If you tell us to do something, we're going to do the opposite 10 times.
No. Yeah, like after, I guess, when Guns N' Roses was in Recess and before David Lowie came knocking on Dizzy's door, he would have been grateful that he's had Hookers and Blow, right? And had already had an audience and, you know, because suddenly you're able to spend more time. He was able to spend more time on it, I guess. But I mean,
yeah.
was there ever any temptation to turn it into like a band, you know, writing originals and a series?
No, never, because, you know, I write songs with Quiet Riot and other projects, and Dizzy writes, you know, he has the solo records out, which I play on as well, some of the tracks. That's completely separate. Hookers and Blow is just covers. Mm-hmm. That's the whole point of it. Well, we vowed never to put out a record, which we broke that vow. and we also vowed never to write songs, so maybe we'll break that vow at some point, but I don't see any point in, I mean, what are we going to write? You know, it's, if anything we write would sound like Dizzy's solo record, or, you know, I mean, I don't, it'd have to be something really different, yeah. Very abstract to work, you know?
Yeah. You're your bandmate in Quiet Riot, Frankie Benali, plays on two songs on this album, self-titled Hookers and Blow album. I wonder when you listen to those songs, you know, I mean, I would just wonder how you feel about the whole thing. Does it make you sad when you listen to it? Does it make you happy?
It's you know, he recorded those in the middle of doing like his 15th chemo treatment, and he really wanted to do it. Went in and did everything like in one or two takes, you know, and just when I hear that, I'm reminded of how strong the guy was, because he played like, you know, you never know, he was 130 pounds, you know, he played like a 20, you know, stage four cancer. He played like a 22-year-old kid in perfect health on those tracks. You never know it when you listen to it. So it kind of makes it actually inspiring to listen to what someone can do even at, you know, 50% or whatever he claimed to be at that day. But still sounds amazing, you know. That just goes to show it, you know, talent is talent, you know.
And for the people listening, we're going to hear a song now. I don't know. Do you want me to play one of those songs?
Yeah, play no quarter.
Thank you.
Hey, this is Alex Frosty from Hookers and Blow and Quiet Riot, and you're watching and listening to White Line Fever Podcast.
Okay, welcome back to White Line Fever. He's back after being on the previous program. If you're listening on the radio, if you're watching, just ignore that. It's Rob Wild from Midnight City. And I'm going to talk to you now about this little section, about what may be a favourite subject, may not be a favourite subject. Melodic Rockfest in Melbourne. You managed to get down to Oz at a time when, you know, I guess a lot of the world was shutting down. And it was newsworthy, to say the least, with what happened down there. Why don't we start at the beginning with the whole story? Sounds fascinating to me. So you get this offer to go and play one show on the other side of the world. Maybe we start there with the story, because I'm sure it's a very interesting story.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. We got offered that show, a long time before we went out to play it. And obviously, you know, I mean, what band doesn't want to go to Australia to play a gig? You know, so it was just like, yeah, we're there. You know, we kind of sorted out all the arrangements and everything was great. I mean, flights were paid for, hotels were paid for. Obviously, we got a fee for playing. So it was all great. You know, we were all excited about going, and then kind of on the lead up to it, it started turning into this kind of I don't know what, nobody really knew what was going on, because all these bands started dropping out, and then bands were saying, well, you know, the visas hadn't been sorted, because obviously we needed visas as well, which the organizers were going to sort for us. So it all went back and forth for a long time, and quite a lot of bands dropped out. I know FM dropped out, and I think Crazy Licks dropped out, and a few other bands dropped out. But we were just like, well, you know, we were in touch with a girl called Sapphire, who was kind of taking care of us, and she kept emailing us, and because we were saying, well, look, is it going to happen or is it not, you know? And she's like, don't worry, it's happening, don't worry, your visas are in, you know, it's all in hand, just don't stress out. So we just kind of left it, and whilst all these other bands were dropping out, we just left it. But I've got to say, I remember we had a rehearsal on the Saturday. We were due to fly out on the Monday, and we got home Saturday, and there was still no, you know, the flights had been paid for, but there was no visas. So obviously there's no way we could get on a plane without our working visas. So, and then Sunday came and went, and still no visas. And we were just thinking, well, that's it. You know, it doesn't look like we're going now. And then I think it was 6 a.m. on the Sunday morning, the Monday morning, we got an email with our working visas. So it was literally about like 3 hours later, we're you know, driving down to Manchester Airport to fly out. So it all kind of worked out. I mean, to be honest with you, I know a lot of a lot of people were kicking off about it online and stuff. And yeah, I think there's certain parts of it that maybe could have been dealt with better. But I'll tell you what, as soon as we got there, we were treated great. Everything that we asked for, we got. Like I said, you know, our flights were covered, our hotel was covered for a week. I mean, we were out there for a week. We ended up playing two shows in the end. We were there for a week. You know, our fee was paid. We got paid on time. So honestly, we had no real complaints. You know, and we'd heard a lot of kind of, you know, all these sort of backstabbing and stuff going on online. But I thought, you know, Peter Hoffman and Pete Naylor were great guys, really, really nice guys. We got along with them really well. And I think, long story short, I think a few of those bands just panicked, because, you know, if they'd have waited maybe a couple of days later, that their visas would have been in their email box, and they'd have been, you know, they missed out. You know, Crazy Licks missed out, and FM missed out, you know, playing in Australia, you know. So,
Rob? Was it? I heard that the crowd wasn't massive, but how was the gig?
It was good. I mean, the when we got there, there was still sort of a little bit of controversy as to who was going to, because bands were sort of arriving at different times, and all the bands were in one hotel. So we were there with Janet Gardner from Vixen and the Enough's Enough guys and the Reckless Love guys. And then there was kind of rumors that this band wasn't going to make it. And this band, you know, someone went to pick them up and they weren't there. But so the festival definitely did get trimmed down. And unfortunately as well, the actual main festival should have been happening in this great, it was like an old theater from the 1920s. Mm. Can't remember the name of it, but it wasn't Festival Hall. It was it was literally just down the road from where we were staying in St Kilda, and we were looking forward to playing that venue because it looked great. You know, it kind of almost looked like a little bit like a smaller version of sort of like the Hammersmith Odeon or something like that. But then it just got moved to a club. It got moved to like a hotel sort of complex, but it was cool. I mean, we still had a great gig. I mean, we went down an absolute storm. I mean, we outsold every other band in merch. We actually got the merch list from Peter Hoffman at the end of the day, and we outsold Reckless Love and every other band on the bill. So we went down really well, and also prior to that, two nights before that, we played a show with Reckless Love and White Widow as well. So we played on the Thursday, and then we played the festival on the Saturday. But you know what, we had a great time. I mean, none of us had ever been to Australia before. It was March, so it was, you know, like leaving cold grey England, and you know, we were like 5 minute walk from the beach, and we were there for a week, which is so unheard. Usually when we go out and play, you know, we'll go and play in Europe or wherever we're going, Japan, and you play and then you kind of, and that's it. You don't really get to see really any of the cities or the countries you go to. But so it was actually great to be just, you know, we were literally based in one place for a week, and we got to know all the locals, and it was great. You know, and people have flown from around the world to come to this festival. I mean, we had some friends of ours who flew over from the UK, came to see us, and people from New Zealand and countries in Europe. So we were just like in the middle of around the gigs, we were just hanging out and having a great time. You know,
sounds awesome. Let's have another song. What can we play next?
I don't know. Why don't we have? Why don't we play Atomic?
From singing my song, everybody's got a little place to be tonight.
Hey, this is Rob Wild for Midnight City, and you're listening to White Line Fever.
Welcome back. And before I introduce our guest, we're going to be talking about the new Night Ranger album, ATPBO, and the band played on. And if you are interested in picking up that record, look in the show notes, because that is where you'll find the links. And without any further ado, the singer and drummer from Night Ranger, Kelly Keegi. How are you, Kelly?
I'm doing good. How are you, sir?
Well.
You're in the UK, that's correct, right?
I am. My accents are Antipodean, but I am actually I'm up in the motherland. I'm in London. And the weather's a bit calmer than it is where you are, I believe, in Arizona. Yeah.
That's right. Got a nice big storm came through at 11 o'clock last night. But all's good this morning. I got all the debris out of the pool, and so now we're here.
Now, I was going to ask you, I've been doing some research, and I'm wondering, you've been doing this for so long, doing interviews to promote new records, and I wonder if it's different now because you've got, I guess people who aren't professional journalists now, they're kind of fans, and they're some of them are trying to push their own YouTube channels, others are just, they just love you, and everyone's got a little bit of a different agenda. Others are trying to get clicks on websites. Well, is it a different experience now doing press for a record than it was 30 years ago?
Well, I mean, we have this, we have this kind of device and this kind of stuff. But, I mean, I think it's basically the same. But what's good about now is that you can be in touch with fans a little bit more. Mm. I mean, I think back in the day, you were a little more isolated and stuff like that. And, that could have been good or bad, but I think it's a good thing. All these devices, all this stuff, why not? I mean, we're kind of promoting ourselves. So you have to be a little more involved that way instead of having somebody to do it for you and all that. So, but I think it's good. I think it's all positive. It's all good.
Yeah. Are the questions harder or are they easier than they were 30 years ago?
Yeah. Are they? Well, I mean, when you're talking about fan base, then it's more like, what's your favorite color?
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, oh my God. But, but not always, but
now, a lot of people think we're going to have a flood of records now because everyone's been in lockdown. With this record, did you try to get in first? You tried to get it out as quickly, in first because not everyone, because we'll talk about that in a minute. But is that what we're going to have? We're going to have a lot of records in the next few months?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing is that, everybody can release a record now. Everybody can do it on their own. They don't need a record company. We've been associated with Frontiers for many, many years, and they've been really good to us, and we've tried to do our best work with them and stuff. And I think we have. The last 10 years, we've been really, kind of stepping up the game since we're producing. So it's like we're not, we're doing everything now, mixing, recording, producing. And so we want to make sure that it's good. We don't want to just do it half-assed. We don't want to do it as good as possible. So it's really time-consuming. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I mean, listening to the record, I'm kind of like, well, I don't know if anyone's going to pay for studio time for you ever again because you did such a good job emailing stuff to each other and doing it that way. I don't know if anyone's going to finance you being together ever again. I mean, you probably should have done a crappier job. You know what I mean?
Well, I mean, there are some expenses, that you do pay. Like I did drums in a studio for the first time in maybe 10 years. I went over to Ken Mary's studio and did drums because I'm in a fairly new house here and I didn't have everything set up. I mean, I can record here, like vocals and just, percussion and stuff like that, but I couldn't do drums. So I went and did that. And then we have like a hub or an engineer or co-producer, Anthony Fox, who's been working with us for many, many years. So he puts all the tracks together in a master and mixes it. Mm-hmm. So we do have some of those. But you're right. We can record at home now.
Yeah.
And I can send myself the bill and pay myself.
The thing I was referring to earlier was people are almost in two camps now. You've got guys who are in like 6-7 bands at once, and they're putting out stuff every couple of months. And then you've got like bands that are saying, we're never going to put out another record again, like Kiss or whatever. Slaughter. I don't know. Like plenty of bands that just aren't putting out any music at all. And you're kind of in the middle there, aren't you? I mean, you're not in a dozen bands. But you are still committed to putting out new music and not just kind of getting on the heritage circuit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we're all committed to this. 100%. And so whenever, you know, every couple of years, you know, we like to go to Japan. We'd love to have new music there. Same thing with, you know, with Europe. And we don't play much over there, but we always want to have a reason to go out and play and not just play the old stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, we like creating new stuff. Every couple of years, it's like we get that itch and we got to do it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we've been about, you know. But the live thing is how we got started. So, you know, that took precedent in the beginning, playing live and learning how to entertain. But then after that, you know, it was like, well, you know, we can't just go out and play. We need music. So it just snowballed after that, every, you know, record tour like that for many, many years, until we started doing it on our own. And then we just decided to, like, we'll concentrate a few years on just playing live and that's it. And then we'll go back and stop everything and make records, you know. Before, you know, you'd have to do both of them at the same time. Like, okay, we gotta, you know, when we're done with this tour, we got to start recording, you know. And it's like, no, that doesn't work all the time, you know.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You don't get do your best work unless you're really focusing. Anyway.
Okay, for the people listening as opposed to those watching, we're going to have a song now, Kelly. What can we play?
You want to play something off the new record? I know we're pushing a couple of singles right now. So there's Breakout and there's Bring It All Home to Me is the second single. There's other songs too. I mean, you choose. I mean,
okay. Well, I really like Breakout. First time I heard it, I thought this is fantastic. So, perfect. Is there a story behind Breakout? Is there?
There is. I mean, you know, it's kind of like everybody's kind of writing an inspiration from the COVID-19 lockdown and all that kind of stuff. So, Breakout had a lot to do with that. Brad Gillis came up with this great piece of music, and Jack, you know, had this idea to do Breakout, and then we started to do it over Zoom calls and stuff like that. And we came up with, it was the last song we recorded, actually. It was just like we needed an extra, you know, what Brad called a barn burner. So he wanted this really like up-tempo thing. And that's where, so he sent that piece of music. We came up with Breakout.
Get right. I think you got too much at stake to lose.
Hi, this is Kelly Kagi from Night Ranger, and you're listening to White Line Fever right here. Turn it up.
Welcome back to White Line Fever. My name's Steve Mascord. Second part of our interview with Josh Todd from Buckcherry. Welcome back, Josh, and everyone who's watching. You've been watching. So the 28 songs written for a 10 song album. What happens to the other 28? Does the quality control mean they get thrown in the trash? The other 18. Do you work with them and maybe they emerge further down the track?
I mean, people always ask that question, you know. There's a reason a song doesn't make a record, and it's just because it's not good enough, you know. And so rarely do we revisit old songs. Sometimes there's a good chorus that we may take from an old song or a good verse or whatever. I think there's probably like maybe three songs that are on the cutting room floor that we could possibly put on a record that are really good, you know, maybe that. But other than that, we always start from a clean slate, you know, the ground up.
Yeah, yeah. With Billy Rowe joining the band, I mean, I'm, you know, old enough to, remember Jet Boy when the first album came out, and later able to go and see them a couple of times. He obviously is a principal in that band, and in your band, you know, he's new. So, you know, is that a hard thing for a musician to get used to? Is it hard for him to get used to where I guess he doesn't have authority, as it were, in your band? You know what I mean? He's new. Is that a weird thing or what?
Yeah, it's a delicate dynamic when you get into a band that's, you know, already put out 8 records and had this, you know, huge career. But he's a veteran and, you know, he's been in the game a long time. That's why we like him. He's a very easygoing guy. And he understands what, you know, his role and how it's going to take time, and that's just it. And he's fitting in very nicely. And like I said, we've been touring out here for over a month, and it's been smooth sailing. And we're having a good time.
Can you tell in your experience, 9 records now? Can you tell after like 2 weeks if it's going to have traction? Like after 2 weeks, can you get a vibe for how it's going to be remembered and how it's going down with the fans, or is that only really something that comes in the fullness of time, you know?
Yeah, you can get a vibe on the build up and the pre-sales and everything. And like, we broke new grounds already with this record. We were debuted number one on the rock charts in the UK. First time ever on any record. Very cool. I think we were the highest charting that we've ever done in Japan as well. And I don't know about Australia. That could be the case too. We are super thrilled. It's very well received. The songs are really great. We're already at over 400,000 views of So Hot. And some of our views of other videos that have been out for years aren't even at that number, you know. So it's going really well. Taking it one day at a time, of course. It's only been a week. You know, all I know is that when we play these songs live, it's incredible to see the reaction. They fit in really nice, and it's making our headlining set like what I always imagined it to be. There's absolutely not one bad song in the set, you know. not that there was a bad song before, but you know what I mean? Every song is like a hit. It's great.
Let's have another song. What song can we hear?
Let's play So Hot. Let your body talk, can you do the walk, breaking hearts again?
to live how you live. Ain't no doubt you're gonna rock the house and let chaos in. I don't think you're an angel. I see no halo. Oh Lord, the story's all getting tangled. Fill in your stable.
This is Josh Todd from Buckcherry, and you're listening to White Line Fever. Check it out.
Welcome back. And wow, our guests today, incredible guests. We've got Dolphin Christian from the Datsuns. Hey, guys, how are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. A bit early to someone to be speaking so loudly and enthusiastically, but I've got to do it. I've got to get people's attention. Guys, look, we, you know, I guess the band kind of... you know, just what was the name of the album? A Deep Sleep. You went into a deep sleep in 2014. And now you've awoken into a very different world, including, I guess, what we're doing now, because everyone's been on Zoom for the last year. Is Eye to Eye about? That's a new record. Is it about this new world?
No. I think usually when, you know, with different themes and stuff that we touch on, it's kind of like more like sort of classical sort of universal things, and I guess that seems to just feel relevant to the times. Coincidentally, I mean, that whole kind of like everything sort of building up into some kind of weird panic or weird strange kind of surreal world we live in, I think that kind of feeling is always around. And I think I'm 42 now, and everyone was, you know, I remember when I was 18 or 19, it was like, oh, it's going to be the new millennium and everything's, you know, it's all going to come crumbling down. And so that kind of feeling, I think, is always there. I just think maybe for like the Western world or whatever, now it's kind of like, oh, yeah, we have to deal with some heavy shit.
Yeah, because I'm a bit older than you. I'm 10 years older than you. And we were different. Like, we had Star Trek and stuff like that. And we thought the future was full of optimism and technology. discover the universe. So there's always been a little bit of doom in your expectations of the future. Is that a big statement? Or
I've always been disappointed by the future, because when I was a kid, there used to be in a book in the library about the year 2000, and apparently, according to the book, we were all going to be living on the moon and have all these amazing gadgets. And so when we got to the year 2000, I was very disappointed by the progress we've made.
You're going to start talking about space 1999 again.
I had a Space 1999 question.
Now's the time.
Because, like, you're using that Space 1999 font on your, you know, on your website, and then the video has kind of got this,
okay,
you know, 70s vibe, and then the cover art is very retro as well. Is that driven by someone in the band? Is there someone in the band who's sort of the artistic controller of all that?
I would say that's me, but usually I sort of gather a few sort of ideas together and then throw, you know, 15, 20 ideas at the other guys and say, how about something like this? And then we go out and find artists, and we pretty much let them do what they like.
Yeah.
And then, you know,
we all like that kind of retro 70s sci-fi sort of stuff. I mean, the Deep Sleep album cover, you know, has that kind of vibe as well. So that's definitely a style that we like to mine.
I mean, that the Deep Sleep cover art is directly from a comic book from 1970, I think.
Yeah, French right. one.
Yeah.
Right. Someone who's unlikely to sue Pope.
No,
it's all legit.
We talk to the artist. It's, you know, credit where credit is due.
Yeah. How do you find, I know it's kind of like one of the boring interviewer questions is, how's the reaction to your new record been? But really, like, there's been quite a, you know, I guess there's been a narrative there, hasn't there, from the first couple of records and John Paul Jones mm-hmm. and all that, and then being indie and then being mainstream again, being a Richard Branson's label and stuff like that. So I just wonder, how can you organically measure, you know, the response you're getting and the type of people who are involved, interested, and the airplay and all that sort of stuff? Is it possible to get a vibe for that?
I think we've always been really bad at looking at those kind of metrics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, especially if you look at the way record sales have been since 2004, particularly onwards, they just go kind of down, and, you know, obviously downloads and streaming's going up. So it's quite hard to sort of look at those metrics, and we're never really kind of good at that. Usually our metric is the shows, people coming out to see us play, what kind of reaction we get. That's interesting. They like this song from a new record, or this song went particularly well. Sometimes it's not the tracks that you expect, or it's not the singles or something. But now we can't play. We haven't played together in a couple of years, and it is very strange, I think.
I also think that nobody really knows those metrics anymore. The whole system and the world around music and distribution consumption is so weird that you could ask the same question of somebody far further up the chain, as it were, and more savvy, and that still wouldn't be able to give you a definitive answer to that kind of question.
Mm. Yeah, because if you look at, like, say, Spotify, which seems to be the main sort of streaming source,
particularly even they're kind of Sweden.
They're a little bit, you get your analytics, but it's still a bit murky and opaque in the way they pay and in the way, this is here and this is there. And yeah, it's a strange time.
For the people listening, we're going to play a song now. So cool. I assume you want to play one off the new record. Have you got one for us? What can we play? And is there a story behind it?
You choose, Duff.
No, I was going to say you choose.
Oh my gosh, what is on the record? Why don't we play one of the ones that's got a video to it so people can check that out. We should start with the first single off the record, which was Brain to Brain.
And that's about social media and voyeurism, is that correct?
Yeah, I guess social media is part of it, but it's more kind of, I guess, in a more general sense, it's kind of like looking at the relationships and interactions around you and just kind of enjoying the drama too much and not being particularly healthy.
Man!
Hello, this is Stoll from the Datsuns, and you're listening, watching Whiteline Fever.
Welcome back to part three of our interview with Marcus from Helloween. I want to thank him for being with us on the last program. You, if you're listening on the podcast, I guess there'll be other ways to listen to this. We played Skyfall, which is a bit of an epic, a bit of a sort of Stairway to Heaven type song, and it's got a real sci-fi theme. If you listen to the lyrics on the last episode, and it's also got a really elaborate and stunning sci-fi video. So I'm going to ask Marcus now about how that video came about, and I guess, you know, you must have felt like you were in Star Wars or something when you were doing the video.
I don't know. Kai came up with this idea, you know, which was actually crying for and he had all these parts. He had all that great ideas together we were working on, and it was finished like right before we started the mix, you know. It took a long time to get this song together because he came up with ideas and other guys came up with some ideas for it, and we didn't know how to set the vocals and who's going to sing what part here and there, which was very, very interesting to me as well as being a part of a band, you know. Till I heard the final mix, I never knew who's going to sing what part of the song, you know, because yeah, they the singer amongst themselves with the producers probably decided how they arranged it with the three singers. And so it was very interesting for me listening to it when the first final mix came out, you know. I kind of loved it this way.
Yeah, no, I guess it's like... For your fans, it's like sort of one of these Marvel franchises where all the superheroes come together, or a Doctor Who where all the old doctors come together with the new doctors. But we mentioned Marcus about how having new members with old members is something that Kiss have done and Guns N' Roses have done in recent times. Those bands no longer see any value in recording new music, putting out new music. I mean, you're obviously not. You know, you're not playing stadiums in America, yes. So it's a little bit different. But I mean, you do see value in it. Is it an artistic imperative, or is it actually a commercial and financial attraction to doing it?
I mean, it's all in all, it's like. Kind of in the middle. You cannot do a big tour without having money. It costs a lot of money, so we sell tickets to finance it all, you know. Of course, there's a lot of money involved, but we spend a lot of money trying to do proper live shows and all that. But it's and we go overseas, we need tickets and we need hotels. We have like a lot of people working with us. Of course, it's a big financial aspect to it, but it's not really the only thing we're doing. It's just what you did for your whole lifetime, what you did for your life, and this is your life. Trying to make it better, trying to put it to the top, trying to get a step ahead every time you do something. Of course, this is a name you got in head when you do another record, when you do another shot, you know. And this is what we were trying to take it to the limit with the stuff we did with the last tour, and taking it to the limit with the record we're doing now. Of course, there's always financial reasons you're doing it. You cannot do a proper record for free. You could do it with a four track, but is it proper enough to be, you know, what you like it to be, you know? But we just love what we're doing, and we just like it's a very emotional process what you're doing, also playing live and going back into the studio, trying to let the songs, trying to let your own baby sound the way you would like it to hear, you know. It's also a very, very emotional process, all that, and that's what music is about, you know. You put it as much emotions into it as possible, you know.
To get the
people, you know, in an emotional mood. That's what music is all about, you know. You hear a song and you'll be reminded of some situations back in your lifetime, you know. That's it. And that's what I love. That's what we're trying to put in that music, you know.
Do you feel that there's been periods since the early 80s when, you know, the music that you do has been out of fashion? And do you feel that now, you know, with bands like Avantasia and some of the younger bands who are doing this sort of melodic, powerful kind of metal, that, you know, it's your time again? Is there a feeling that there's a revival and a renewed relevance and resonance to the music you do?
I mean, with a new lineup, with the Pumpkins United, we felt like we're being, especially after the tour, doing the new record. It was kind of a reborn for us, if you like. So that's why we decided to just call it Halloween, because this is the basic of Halloween, you know. Is this, no, we were talking about calling it something Skyfall plus blah blah blah, but you know, it doesn't need anything else but Halloween, because this is the essence of Halloween, what you can hear now. I mean, of the newborn Halloween, with the two new members, with the two new old members, with everybody in there, we thought it's a classical lineup plus some extras, you know, which is cool, having all those voices, having all those guitars in there. It's just Halloween, the roots, Halloween essence, plus special editions, so to say.
Okay, we'll have another song. We'll come back with the final couple of questions. What song can we play, Marcus?
It's maybe Down in the Dumps.
I got a white line fever. Going to run land down under. Going to turn around the corner way down yonder. And I'm not even going to try to rhyme anymore. Michael Monroe here for White Line Fever and Dig, Michael Monroe Sensory Overdrive, the album, the band. You get a chance, come and check us out live. We're going to rock your socks off and whatever, rock like fuck. That's what I say, okay? Come on down and rock on.